Since the dawn of civilization, spies of every nation and culture have worked to infiltrate their adversaries and glean the information that will give their side the advantage. The stakes are sky high, the strategies varied and imaginative, and the ultimate sign of success is that no one ever even knew you were there. In each episode, we will explore the moral and ethical gray zones of espionage, where treachery and betrayal go hand in hand with cunning and courage. This is the Spycraft 101 podcast. Welcome to your clandestine classroom. This is episode number 138 of the Spycraft 101 podcast. My guest this week is Dr. Catherine Olmsted. Catherine is a professor of history at the University of California, Davis, where she has taught since 2001. She's published 5 books and many journal articles focusing on the political and cultural history of the United States since World War I. I invited Catherine onto the podcast to discuss her second book, Red Spy Queen, a biography of Elizabeth Bentley, published in 2002. Elizabeth Bentley was a spy and agent handler for the Communist Party of the United States and for the Soviet Union from the late 1930s through World War II. But in 1945, she broke ties with both organizations and walked into an FBI field office to alert them to the presence of a massive and almost completely unknown espionage ring that had penetrated the U.S. government at many different levels. She became a media sensation and helped to alert Congress and the American public to the new Cold War that they found themselves in with the USSR. But before we dive into this story, I want to ask you a question. Have you ever wondered if you have what it takes to perform a covert operation yourself? A long infill or exfill on foot, with a pack on your back, and your life on the line? If so, there's one way you can find out. SOE Expeditions is now offering guided expeditions that recreate some of the most arduous missions of World War II. This is not an afternoon walking tour. This is a multi-day foot patrol through rough terrain, keeping to a timetable just like the men who came before you did. You will put yourself in their shoes and find out exactly what you're made of. This is not for the faint of heart or the out of shape. There are several expeditions each year, with the next one traveling to the island of Crete in the Mediterranean, where you'll memorialize the 80th anniversary of the Special Operation Executive's mission to kidnap a German general and spirit him off the island to Egypt. This 7-day expedition will cover 80 miles of mountainous terrain along the SOE escape route to the coast and to safety. Then, coming in March 2025 in Norway, is a trek along the route of Operation Ripe on the 80th anniversary of the only sabotage mission by the American OSS to take place in Norway. All expedition participants will be equipped with a Talus cold weather jacket made by Kiela at no additional charge. Are you tough enough to follow in the footsteps of the Special Operations Executive? Find out more at soeexpeditions.com or click the link in the show notes of this episode. Catherine, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. I'm really glad that we can finally talk about this because I've touched on this period of history in a few previous episodes, but I haven't really talked about Elizabeth's story at all. So I'm really glad for that opportunity today because she was quite a pivotal figure.
Yeah, she was a fascinating character.
So what was it that led you to write about her in the first place?
Well, I started researching her about 25 years ago. So it was in the late 1990s, and there were a lot of stories about documents coming out of the former Soviet Union. So after the end of the Cold War, there was briefly a time when the Russians were releasing Cold War documents about espionage. And these documents then provided the opportunity to find out if people who claimed that they were spies or accused other people of being spies in the 1940s and 50s were telling the truth. And so I was reading these stories and started thinking I would write a book about American women who spied for the Soviet Union in the 1930s and 40s. And as I started researching Bentley's story, she sort of took over the whole book because she had such a long career as a spy, and she was so much more significant than the other women that I was thinking about writing chapters on that I decided, you know, she deserves her own book.
Yeah, she certainly did. I was amazed at just what like a reach she had across the entire enterprise, really, of Soviet espionage here in the United States. I mean, she truly knew everyone and everything is kind of what it felt like to me. And that, you know, played out poorly for the Soviets in the end, as I'm sure we'll get into later on, but quite a pivotal figure, like we mentioned.
Right.
So what was her early life like then, growing up here in the U.S., I guess, in the, what, like 1910, something like that, probably?
Right. She had a very conventional early life. She was born in Connecticut, moved around a little bit in the mid-Atlantic area, ended up in upstate New York. Her parents were Republican, Episcopalian. She believed that she had been descended from a Mayflower passenger. So she was, you know, as American as you could be. Her roots were very white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant American. So there was nothing in her early life that would lead you to suspect that she would become a communist, let alone a spy.
Okay. So clearly something big happened later on, I guess, which is usually the case. Can you talk a little bit about the, I guess I would call it the ideological swings that she went through as a young woman, because she certainly seemed to veer back and forth across the political spectrum?
Yeah, she did. And I don't think it's necessarily because she was that ideological. It's just because she was very influenced by the people around her. So in graduate school, she was studying Italian literature at Columbia University in New York City, and she studied abroad in Italy, which was fascist at the time. And so she knew lots of fascists, and she hung around fascist groups and was accepted as fascist leaning by them. And then when she came back to the United States, she was living in New York City in the 1930s. There was a very large communist presence in the United States, especially in New York City. And she had good friends who were communists, and they invited her to marches and parades and to parties. So then she became a communist, not necessarily because she was reading Marx, but because, or she had any sort of ideological affinity. It was just that now her friends were communists rather than fascists. And so she wanted to hang out with them. Communism at that time also provided her with a community. It was a very demanding ideology where you were expected to give about 10% of your income to the party and go to lots of events. She found that fascinating, and it gave her a sense of belonging and purpose.
I see. Actually, I'm glad that you mentioned that she didn't really believe too much in what she was talking about. I seem to recall that she made a statement that's covered in your book where she tried to read some of Marx's writings a few times, and she read it 3 or 4 times and didn't really understand it. So she just stopped reading at that point. I was very shocked by that, because she was such an integral part of their operations, of the communist operations here. But it's amazing that she wasn't really a devout believer, but she was very much willing to take action on their behalf.
Right. She thought they were her friends, and she thought they were fun. I think also she liked to shock people. So when she thought about by this point, her parents were dead. But when she thought about the people that she had grown up with and her very conservative background and small town, I think it gave her a little thrill to have them think, oh, my goodness, now Betty Bentley is a communist.
Okay, I can understand that. And that actually leads me to my next question, because she turned into something of a rule breaker as a young woman. And you mentioned her very conventional background. So was she kind of rebelling against her upbringing in some way? Or was there any particular catalyst for her to start breaking the rules left and right as she got older?
There doesn't seem to have been any particular catalyst. She just seems to have gotten a thrill from rebellion. In that sense, maybe she was ahead of her time. She went to Vassar, which is an elite women's college at the time, and it was against the rules there to smoke, yet she smoked, and she got in trouble a couple of times. It was prohibition, yet she drank. She went to Italy, as I said, and partied with fascists. She came back and partied with communists. She was always looking for something that would shock the folks back in Connecticut.
I see. Well, she certainly accomplished that later in life, far beyond what she was doing when she was at Vassar, I suppose.
Right.
So, Catherine, what was it that brought her into the Communist Party of the USA? That's a kind of a big step from what you just mentioned, partying with your friends who also happen to be communists. Did she decide that that was like a genuine, I don't know if I call it a career path, but a move for her was to actually join the party officially?
Well, she joined the party officially because some of her close friends were members, and that was relatively unusual. Probably there were 10 times as many people who were small C communists as capital C communists who never actually joined the party. Because as I said, it was quite a commitment. You were expected to go to several meetings a week and pay a lot of money in dues. And so most people never made that commitment. However, she did. I think it's just because it made her feel special and important to be part of this revolutionary organization. And she really enjoyed the people she met.
Okay, I see. Does she have any particular role prior to actually becoming a spy? Did she have a role within the party, like a board membership or anything like that?
No, not really. I mean, she was an activist, but she wasn't a party official. But very quickly, okay, she decided that what she wanted to do was to be a spy, because that, again, she was a rule breaker. I think that sounded fun to her, because being a spy, of course, you are manipulating and deceiving people. There's a certain feeling of power that thrills a certain personality type, and she certainly was of that personality type.
Okay, I see. So once again, this was primarily, you think, for the thrill of it rather than, you know, a desire to harm U.S. national interests or anything like that, or for the, you know, monetary reward she might receive. It was just because she enjoyed this adventurous new undertaking.
Right. I mean, I think probably if you're doing a spy podcast, you've come across the initialism MICE for explaining why people become spies. MICE, either money, ideology, compromise. In other words, they're being blackmailed, or ego. And she was definitely in the ego category. It gave her a thrill to know secrets and to continue to hold on to secrets in personal relationships.
Yes, it's happened many times, certainly. So how do you move then from being a member of the Communist Party of the USA to actually becoming a spy for them and later on for the Soviet Union? Like, who was the person, or what was the impetus to actually move and take that next step?
Well, there were some party members who were noting her and thinking that she might have possibilities as a spy, because at that time, the stereotype was that party members, the communists, and certainly spies were immigrants. If they were communists, that they were disproportionately Jews, that they were disproportionately impoverished, or at least, you know, working class. And she wasn't any of those things. So obviously, if you're looking for a good communist spy, she would be an ideal candidate, because the FBI, a lot of the people that she might be interacting with, would never suspect her of being one. However, she really ended up activating herself. She got a job at a fascist information bureau, essentially like a propaganda bureau for Mussolini's Italy in New York City. And as she was working there, she realized that the communists might be interested in gossip that she overheard or documents that she saw in this fascist organization. So she decided to volunteer herself as a spy, and she approached party leaders and said, "Would you like me to spy on the fascists for you?" And then she moved on from spying on Italians to being trained to spy on other Americans.
Okay, I see. And was this when this guy, Jacob Golos, came into her life? I know he was a very, very influential person, probably the most influential person in her whole life, as a matter of fact.
Right. She had a lot of boyfriends in her life, but he was definitely, I think, the one who was the love of her life. She was with him for about 5 years, from the late 30s to 1943, when he died. And he was introduced to her to train her, because he was a Soviet spy. He was a case officer, which meant that he handled people. So that's an important distinction. Neither Golos nor Bentley was an agent, in that they didn't infiltrate U.S. government offices and steal documents or try and seduce their targets. Instead, what they did was recruit and handle and manage other American agents or foreign agents. And so Golos was her case officer. And as he was training her, they fell in love, and she ended up becoming his assistant.
Okay, I see. And you mentioned that she had this sort of advantageous background and appearance, but did she also have sort of the skills that they needed for all of this? I mean, did she take to it naturally, or did she require a lot of training, anything like that?
No, she took to it naturally. She enjoyed learning the tradecraft, you know, how to figure out if you're being followed, how to follow someone else, how to see if your apartment has been broken into while you were gone, how to do a dead drop, how to use disappearing ink. She loved all that sort of thing. But also, I think that she was a very shrewd person. She wasn't a true scholar. As we noted, she didn't like reading Marx, but, and so she wasn't somebody that you would say, oh, she's brilliant, but she had a lot of street smarts, and that helped her a lot, both while she was a spy and then later when she was trying to figure out how to get the best deal for herself when she was a defector.
Okay. That was very lucky for them to find exactly the right person at exactly the right time. And I guess that she kind of made herself available, not so much that they found her. So you mentioned that Golos passed away in 1943. What happened there? Was he caught or something?
No, he died of a heart attack. He was quite a bit older than she was and had a bad heart, which was why he was training her to take over for him, to take over more and more of his responsibilities as he felt worse and found it difficult to leave the apartment. He trained her to go meet his sources, his agents, to collect their documents. So at first she was mainly a courier for him, but then she became someone who actually recruited new agents and met with them and calmed them down if they were starting to worry that maybe they should stop spying. So he trained her to be a case officer. And by the time he died in 1943, she was basically running his network for him anyway.
Okay. So he already had this pre-existing network and she kind of expanded it and then later took it over entirely after he passed.
Right.
Okay. And who were some of her significant agents? I mean, she spread she cast the net pretty wide across the U.S. government, as I understand it.
She did. She did not have as her personal agents, many people that you would have heard of, unless you're sort of a real geek about Soviet espionage in America during World War II. She had agents primarily in the Treasury Department and the Bureau of Economic Warfare. What she was most interested in getting for the Soviets were she wanted documents on U.S. production, U.S. war production, and also U.S. estimates of the Germans' war production and U.S. Intelligence on what the Germans were planning next and where they were making their weapons and where they were planning attacks. So, I mean, the U.S. and the Soviets were allied during World War II. And so a lot of Elizabeth Bentley's sources believed that they weren't committing treason by giving this information because they believed that the U.S. government should be giving it to the Soviets anyway because they were their wartime allies. But in fact, it was a very fraught, vexed alliance where the U.S. government was distrustful of the Soviets, even as the Soviets were fighting the same enemy. And so the Soviets were also distrustful of the U.S. government and believed that the U.S. government was hiding things from them. And so they used their agents to get the inside information of what the U.S. government knew about the European war, but then also how quickly the U.S. government was building munitions to fight the Nazi threat.
Okay, I see. This was a lot of stuff that we were, I guess it was close hold, but at the same time, like you said, the Soviets were our allies. And in fact, since you mentioned the war production, I know we supplied the Soviets with a great deal of equipment during the war. And so some of that stuff was stuff that was probably going to go to them anyway. I guess they just wanted or needed advance notice of just how much we were creating. Does that
right,
sound right?
Right. They were, it was sort of like they were double checking what the official sources in the U.S. government were telling them by getting secret information so that they could make sure the U.S. government wasn't lying to them. I mean, her biggest source was a man named Greg Silvermaster, who at various times was in the Treasury Department and the Bureau of Economic Warfare. He, in turn, had other agents, and they would look for reports on wartime production, feed them to Silvermaster, and he would feed them to her.
Okay, I see. And it seemed like for a while, they're kind of at the height of all of this. She was extraordinarily busy. She was doing so many meetings with so many people all over town, all over the region, really. I mean, she had a huge network, and she was providing a great deal of information of varying quality, I suppose, but she was certainly generating a lot of information for the Soviets.
Right. And some of her agents weren't in the government. They were just people who were useful, who could give her gossip. Like, she was one of her agents, her friend, an unknowing person, was a secretary for a major journalist. And so she would gather this information in Washington and in New York City and then pass it along to the Soviets. And even as she was working really full time as a case officer, she had a day job at a tourist agency that was her cover. So she was busy all the time.
Right. I see. So as I understand it, if I recall correctly from your book, although she was very productive and successful, the Soviet intelligence was actually not head over heels for her. Like, they did not entirely trust her either.
Not at all. It's sort of an accident that she ended up heading this network, because it was not typical for any intelligence service in the world at that time to give a woman so much responsibility. And the Soviets talked a lot about women's equality. They were theoretically committed to gender equity, but it was really mostly in theory. Mm-hmm. In practice, they discriminated against women. And so just the idea that she was a woman counted against her for them. But on the other hand, Goldos died in 1943. It's the middle of World War II. The Soviets were at that point really fighting for their existence. So the spy masters in Moscow really didn't want to take a whole lot of time to think about how to replace Golos when his assistant was right there and she could just take over without any training or any break. And so they decided, okay, we'll just let her be the new Golos. But then very quickly, they started to regret that. He was from Russia. He was an ideological communist. And, you know, she began to get more and more disillusioned. She had not so much been working for the Soviets as she had been working for Golos. And once he was gone, she got disillusioned. She really didn't like her NKGB handlers. She thought they were murderers and thugs. And also, she had a lifetime problem with alcohol, which got even worse after the love of her life died. So she started to drink too much. She had a lot of affairs. She liked to go to bars every night and pick up different men. I mean, this is not real good tradecraft. And so they started to think, do we really want this woman who seems like she's not a committed communist, who's really not at all concerned about security and who is drunk a lot of the time? Do we want to have her in charge? So that's when they started talking about replacing her.
Okay, I see. And as I recall, Golos, he was very good. And he was, like you said, originally from Russia and everything, but he also was kind of difficult for them to control from afar because he kind of did what he wanted in some way. So I have to assume that his handpicked successor also would have kind of an uphill climb to build trust with the NKGB at that point, since they had already had a few issues with him.
Right. And remember, this is the NKGB. I mean, there's no organization that is more suspicious and paranoid.
Right. Absolutely. So as the war ends, I mean, the big kind of moment in her life comes when she decides to break with the Soviets. Was there a specific incident that led to that? Or did she feel like just the tables had turned with the end of the war or something else?
Well, yes, there's both long-term factors and then a specific catalyst. The long-term factor would be that she realized that the KGB was getting tired of her, that, you know, she was meeting with her handler, showing up drunk, saying aggressive things. And she realized that his patience was wearing thin. And she knew that the KGB did routinely assassinate people that they thought might jeopardize their secrets. So she was worried about the KGB. She was also worried about the FBI. And she began to imagine that FBI agents were following her, that they were going through her things. It turns out this wasn't true, but she really thought the FBI was closing in on her. And then in the summer of 1945, the war was drawing to a close, and she started to think, well, what happens if I'm spying for another country that's not allied with the United States? I mean, during the war, she could always say, well, I was spying for an ally, and that might help minimize any responsibility that she had. But once the war ended, then she could well be viewed as spying for an enemy, and espionage could bring the death penalty. So she was worried about getting caught. She was worried about getting assassinated by the KGB. You know, one night when she was at a bar, she met a man named Peter Heller, who she became convinced was part of an FBI sting to catch her. He said to her offhand something like, you know, you may not know this about me, baby, but I'm a big time government spy. And he said this because this is what he said to women he met in bars. He was actually a curtain salesman from Brooklyn with a wife and kids. But she thought, oh my God, you know, this man has been sent by the FBI to catch me. So that was the final straw for her. And so she decided to explore defecting. So she first went to an FBI office in the summer of 1945 and started to talk about what she had done. But she was very oblique. And the FBI agent that she talked to actually thought that she was lying, might be some sort of psychopath. So it didn't go anywhere. But then as they did not pursue her information, she thought more about it and decided that she was going to try once again to defect, but this time be much more direct. And that time it worked.
Yeah, I have to admit, I can kind of understand her walking into an office and laying out this grand conspiracy, and all of it's true, but it would seem very hard to believe at first glance when you've never heard of this woman and the Soviets are our allies and everything. She says, oh, we have our fingers in every pie and we're spread throughout the government.
Right.
We've been here for years. It would kind of be hard to take that seriously until you really dive into it and realize just how bad it has all been.
Right. Right. So she expected them to move on that, but they didn't because they didn't know what to make of her or what she said. But when she, you know, redefected a couple of months later, she was much more specific and she was able to get their attention and they responded instantly at that point.
Okay. So what was their initial reaction with her? I mean, she was, you know, essentially admitting to committing espionage for another country. So were they planning to try to double her back or just use her testimony against members of her network or arrest her or something like that?
Right. Well, what they did was, you know, immediately essentially promise her immunity in return for her statement. And she met with them for 3 solid days and they came up with a statement that was more than 100 pages long where she listed everyone that she could think of, including people that, you know, she had heard mentioned, like I was out to dinner with so-and-so and they said that they had met someone named Joe Smith. And so they'd write Joe Smith down as well. So it was a very capacious statement that she provided. She had no evidence, though. Unlike, say, Whitaker Chambers, who defected with the Pumpkin Papers, she had nothing. It was just her word. And so they were hoping, the FBI was hoping to then double her and send her out to meet her agents again, only with FBI surveillance so that they could catch people in the act. Because since she had no evidence, they knew that they could not get convictions unless they were able to persuade her sources to do something in front of the FBI.
Before we go on, I want to let you all know about a new educational tool you're not going to want to miss. It's the Gray Man Briefing Classified. By now, I think I know my listeners pretty well, and take it from me, this briefing is exactly the news and educational reference source that you've been looking for. You'll get breaking news updates from all over the world on topics including planned protests and riots, low-intensity conflicts, natural disaster alerts, cyber attacks, supply chain disruptions, and more. You'll also get access to articles that help you build your own skills, including urban survival, home security, counter-surveillance, escape and evasion techniques, and more. And this is much more than just a newsletter in your inbox. Joining the Gray Man Briefing Classified also includes invitation-only channels on the Telegram and Signal apps for convenient real-time updates. The newsletter subscription is normally $5 per month, but if you use the code GBCSpycraft, you can save 20% each month for the life of your subscription. I'm already a member myself and have been reading and learning a lot since I first subscribed. Look it up yourself at graymanbriefing.com. That's gray with an A, graymanbriefing.com. And use the discount code GBCSpycraft to save 20% right from the start. Hmm. Okay, I see. So it's a this is sort of a tough nut to crack in some ways, then, like you mentioned. So since you said that there's no evidence, is that because like all of the documents and that sort of thing had been passed on and were not retained? Like she didn't have anything laying around that could, you know, prove that such and such a person at the State Department had given
right, right. And she never did have sources at the State Department, but even, you know, she did have sources at the Treasury Department. She a lot of material had passed through her hands, but she had not thought to keep any of it. So she had no proof.
I see. Okay, I see. And how long did it take for the Soviets to realize that she had gone over to the FBI? Was it within days, weeks, months?
Well, this is one of the most fascinating parts of the story, and one that we didn't know until the 90s, is that they knew instantly. So really? For a long time, her contemporaries and then historians doubted her story because it seemed that she might have lied because all of the people that were her sources after the FBI started watching, gave no evidence of spying. They were just like, there was nothing for the FBI to observe. And so, you know, it made a certain amount of sense for people to say, well, she must have made it up because the FBI wasn't able to catch anybody doing anything remotely untoward. Well, what happened was that when she defected, J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI kept that information very close. He didn't even tell President Truman the name of the defector or her gender. In all of the FBI memos, she's given a male cover name, Gregory, and referred to with he, him pronouns, because they were trying to hide her identity, obviously. So they were hopeful that they could put her out in the field and that her sources would not know that she had turned. However, even though this information was only told to a handful of people, it was passed on to the British because they were affected too. And one of the handful of people in British intelligence who was told was Kim Philby, who was in charge of Soviet counterintelligence and, of course, a Soviet spy himself. So he immediately told the Soviets, and then the Soviets immediately told their KGB people in North America, and they contacted all of their spies and said, stop, you know, just stop spying. The FBI is watching. Don't do anything suspicious. And some of them they exfiltrated, you know, the most important ones to Mexico and then to the Soviet Union, and others, they just said, don't spy for the rest of your life because the FBI will be watching you.
Always one step ahead.
Yeah.
My goodness. So did she ultimately, this is, of course, this is an enormous life-changing step for her. Did she have any doubts or regrets after she went to the FBI and thought maybe she should have, you know, stuck with the Soviet intelligence for any reason?
I don't think she thought she should have stuck with the Soviet intelligence because she knew that they were out to get her. Certainly, and we know from the Russian documents that, in fact, they discussed various ways of killing her. They just stopped short of actually doing it. There's this really interesting series of telegrams back and forth where the guy in New York who knows her, who really wants to kill her because he thinks she's dangerous, says, you know, well, we could throw her off a bridge. We could poison her coffee. You know, we could shoot her in a dark alley. And he's proposing all of these different ways to kill her. And the people in Moscow keep saying, no, that's not necessary. Either because they're distracted or just they just don't want to kill a woman. It's unclear. Mm-hmm. But so she knows that she was in danger from the Soviets. She doesn't regret breaking with the Soviets, but she does on a personal level, I think, pay a certain price for betraying the people that were her friends. So she does seem to regret that their lives are ruined. As I said, she's always had a drinking problem, but it just accelerates throughout her life so that by the time that she is a defector and a witness, she is really having trouble controlling her alcohol consumption.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she becomes quite a handful for the FBI, although at first I know it seemed like sort of the goose that lays golden eggs, but in the end she became difficult to handle herself.
Right. Yeah. In researching the book, as I said, I did it 25 years ago, so I was fortunate to be able to contact about four of the FBI agents who had been assigned to her. They all had very mixed feelings about her because she, on the one hand, they were very grateful for her testimony. They very much, you know, agreed with what she had done, but she had been impossible to handle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's unfortunate for her. Did that ultimately harm her statements, or did it harm the cases that she brought or anything like that, her personal behavior, or did it just kind of mar the opinion of the people that were closest to her?
It mainly meant that the FBI agents who were watching her were somewhat suspicious of what she said. Certainly, the reporters who wrote stories about her were very suspicious of her truthfulness.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this ultimately led to a series of like public hearings and testifying before Congress rather than a lot of arrests and public trials for the most part. So why is that? Why did they end up doing the congressional testimony, kind of going that route instead of a lot of criminal cases?
Well, because she didn't have the goods to get these people convicted, because she brought no evidence with her. So it wasn't enough. To get convicted of espionage, you need to have at least two sources. And the U.S. government knew that it couldn't convict anyone based on her testimony alone, especially considering all of the various ways that her character could be attacked by any competent defense attorney.
Right.
And also because, you know, the Soviets had warned all of their sources, so they weren't spying anymore.
Sure. Understandable. Were there ultimately any convictions? Was anybody actually arrested based on her testimony or her statements?
Not really. There was one of her sources was ultimately convicted of perjury, a guy named William Remington. But nobody was convicted of espionage based on her testimony alone. She did testify in the case of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, but she really had a very peripheral role there. She just testified that someone named Julius had been one of Golo's sources, but that was all she knew.
Okay, I see. And do you know, or well, I should say, does anyone know really how many actual confirmed spies she actually named? And then, you know, with the hindsight of a lot of historical research, like how many people that she named, their names, were they actually spying for the Soviets at that time, even if they weren't convicted? It was, I believe, dozens or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was probably some dozens. Some of them maybe unknowingly, you know, she befriended them. She got them, like the woman who was the secretary to the journalist, she got them to share documents. But yeah, probably close to three dozen people she got information from and passed to the Soviet Union, either with their connivance or without their knowledge.
Hmm. Okay. And most of them, they kind of were saved, essentially, just because they stopped doing what they were doing. Kim Philby, I guess, in a sense, saved all of them from any public trials or repercussions for the most part. They just had to stop what they were doing.
Yeah. I mean, you could certainly put the emphasis there that Philby saved all these people. You could also say that she, in a way, destroyed Soviet intelligence in America for several years. Because, you know, they rolled up all their networks in response to her defection. So it meant that they had to start all over again. And there was a period of years there where they had very little intelligence in America. And once they did start establishing sources and networks again, mostly it was based on money that they paid people, that never again would they have that opportunity to manipulate people on the basis of ideology or on the basis of this argument, hey, we're fighting the same enemies. Why don't you share information with us?
Okay, I see. So at what point did the public at large learn about her? Was it like right when her testimony started? Was it all public testimony at that time? Or was it closed door stuff with Congress initially?
Well, for the first 3 years, nobody in the public or in Congress knew about her story. So she defected in 45. She goes public in 48. Oh. For about a year, the FBI was trying to run her as a double agent, then that failed. And then the Justice Department was trying to get together a case against communist leaders. Just for, at that time, you could be convicted of the Smith Act, violating the Smith Act for just being a communist. So they started using her in secret grand jury testimony to try to convict Communist Party leaders who were not spies of being communists. So they were using her that way. But again, it was secret. And it wasn't until 1948 that she essentially took it on her own, decided on her own to go public. This was because she noticed that there were ex-communists who were making a lot of money selling their books. saying, you know, I used to be a communist and then I saw the light and let me tell you about the dangers to our country. And that was a very lucrative genre by 1948. And she essentially thought to herself, well, you know, boy, I have a much better story than those people where they're just saying, I used to be a communist. I can say I used to be a communist and I used to be a Soviet spy. So she actually approached the FBI about, you know, can I go talk to the press? And they said no, because they wanted to control her. And so then she secretly went to the press against FBI instructions and told her story to a couple of right-wing newspapers in New York City. And then as a result of those stories, she was called to testify before Congress. And that's when she really became a public name.
Okay, I see. So I understand some of this was because she was also kind of in financial distress by this point. I think the FBI was taking a little bit of care of her, but not to the level that she wanted or needed. So it was a need for publicity and to sell her own story and that sort of thing, correct?
Right, right. I mean, when she was working for the KGB, as I said, she was also had this day job of running this tourism and shipping company that paid her a lot of money. I think it was probably a couple hundred thousand dollars a year in today's money. So she was used to living well. And when she became an FBI source, they paid her, but not very much. And so she was really looking enviously at the ex-communists who were selling their life stories for a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I believe that you mentioned that her own personal life started to kind of spiral out of control, like her addiction issues, like you had mentioned before, once she was in the public spotlight, those kind of worked against her, didn't they?
Oh, my goodness. Yes, very much so. She was never able to get her alcoholism under control after that. And because of that, I think largely she sort of had this downward spiral where first she got a job teaching at a college and then at a prestigious girls' high school, and then at a, you know, a regular high school, then at a prison, making less and less money. She had a series of boyfriends who were not at all good for her, one of whom was quite abusive. And of course, all of her friends from her former life would have nothing to do with her.
Sure,
so
sure.
She had no support network. It was a very sad last 10 years of her life.
Oh, man. Okay. That's unfortunate for her, certainly. And on top of that, I have to wonder, did the Soviet intelligence, did they kind of reconsider that decision to spare her life early on? I mean, did she have a target on the back on our back for the remainder of her days after that?
Yeah, well, for the first 5 years or so, she was very much in the news, and they were afraid to kill her then because it would obviously be a Soviet operation, mm-hmm. and they didn't want to have that kind of publicity. Then over time, I think they did start to, there is indication in the former Soviet files that they started to think, whatever happened to that woman, what should we do? And like the last note in her file is somebody asking, you know, where was she living, but not making a whole lot of effort to find out where that was. So I think she had just become irrelevant by that point, so they didn't devote the resources that were necessary to tracking her down and actually finally killing her.
I see. So she just sort of faded into obscurity at the end of her life there?
She did, yes.
I believe, was it because of her alcohol and health issues that she ultimately passed away or something unrelated?
Yeah, well, she died at age 55. I think it was like abdominal cancer that, you know, could have been triggered or exacerbated by alcoholism.
Okay. So yeah, that's pretty young there, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So what do you think is her legacy now? I mean, it seems like almost no one would know her story better than you did. I mean, she did a tremendous service at the end of the war by essentially dissolving these Soviet networks right when they really needed them the most. But she had a very complex story beyond that as well.
Yeah, she did. I would say it's a very complicated legacy. On the one hand, there's just the very interesting story of a woman who had this important managerial role in a major spy agency for many years. And so it's an interesting story in intelligence history and an interesting story about gender in intelligence history. So there's that legacy, that sort of the personal legacy. As far as her political legacy would go, though, I would say that first, There's what you mentioned, that she played a very important role in destroying Soviet espionage in America for a period of years, simply by going to the FBI, telling them everything that she knew, so that then the Soviets panicked and weren't sure what she knew. And so they closed up everything and deactivated almost all of their spies in North America for a period of years. So that's an important legacy. The other legacy, though, would be that her public testimony started out quite straightforward about what she had actually done, but became more exaggerated over time, so that I think she was conscious of the need to continue to keep the media's interest by coming up with new stories, new accusations that she hadn't made in the past that were quite possibly untrue. And so her hyperbole, her deceptions in her public testimony, especially by the 1950s, really helped to convince the American public that there were communists everywhere in government and that the nation faced a severe domestic threat. And by that point, that really wasn't true, in part because she had caused the Soviets to roll up their spy networks. Mm-hmm. So she caused people to worry about communist spies in America after that was no longer an issue. So she helped contribute to the McCarthyism of the 1950s.
Yeah, just a tremendous amount of paranoia for something that had been pretty well mitigated to that point, at least for the foreseeable future, I guess. But it certainly, that was the topic of the day for quite some time there, late 40s, early 50s and on.
Right.
Fascinating stuff. It's unfortunate that her own life kind of got in the way of her story as well, because it seems like she was very good at what she did in her heyday. You know, she was very, very effective at running the networks in so many ways and very effective at dismantling them in the end as well. It's unfortunate that those issues kind of surfaced in the end to mar her otherwise very, very unique story.
Right. She was in many ways a shrewd, strong woman who, because of the way that her life unfolded, ended up being viewed as this delusional, crazy old spinster who made up a bunch of lies. Mm-hmm. And it's really a much more complicated story than that.
Certainly is. Certainly is. Well, thank you, Catherine. This has been incredible. For the listeners who want to learn more about her story, strongly, strongly encourage you to pick up Catherine's book. It's Red Spy Queen, a biography of Elizabeth Bentley. Very, very interesting read, like I said, and there's certainly a lot more to it than what we've discussed here. Catherine, thank you so much. Are you working on another book right now, or do you have any other projects going on at the moment?
You know, not at the moment.
Okay. You're still teaching currently, right?
I'm still teaching, yes. I'm sort of between projects as I'm figuring out. I've always been sort of fascinated by the way that these American women who spied for other countries were portrayed in the press. So I'm starting to think about doing a cultural history of American espionage, but okay. That's still sort of a long way in the future.
Yeah, that would be very interesting to me as well. That's a great project. It is funny, you did mention it. We didn't really cover it during our discussion just now, but the way she was portrayed almost as a femme fatale in some ways in the news media reports. And like the title of your book was a phrase that was coined about her, the Red Spy Queen, you know, which conjures up images of two people and that don't necessarily match with who she really was, but she kind of became a product to be sold by the newspapers of the time is what it seemed like to me.
Right. Definitely. They definitely constructed an image for her, which, you know, sometimes she tried to help them with that if it was advantageous to her, but in the end it just her image mm-hmm. as this blonde spy queen only undermined her credibility.
Yeah. What a story. Fascinating stuff. Well, thank you again so much, Catherine. I really appreciate it, your time, and this is a great discussion, and I'm always glad to dive into this period because it really is just an endlessly complex and fascinating period of time, isn't it?
Yes, it sure is.
Thanks
for inviting me.
Absolutely. Take care. If you're interested in more of Spycraft 101, look for my page on Instagram at Spycraft 101. You can also find more great articles on my website, spycraft101.com. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you'll stick around because there is lots more to come.
Disclaimer. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only. The stories and statements expressed herein are experiences and opinions. They may not reflect the views of the host or the production studio. It's okay if you disagree with our content. No piece of media is right for everyone. If you love Spycraft 101, please check us out online, on Instagram, on YouTube, and especially on Patreon. Thank you for listening.